So, have you ever stepped outside on a perfectly clear, freezing cold night, and just looked up at a sky absolutely choked with stars?
Oh, yeah, that sudden dizzying sense of vertigo.
Exactly. It's like not just the physical chill in the air, but the staggering weight of the ultimate question.
Right.
You look at that endless expanse of black space and you wonder, why is there something rather than nothing?
It really is the oldest, most haunting question in human history.
Yeah. And maybe even more aggressively, more intimately, why are you specifically standing there on the grass looking up and experiencing all of this from behind your own eyes?
It's a massive mystery. I mean, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz famously framed the something rather than nothing dilemma way back in his work, Principles of Nature and Grace.
Right.
And honestly, every attempt to answer it usually just pushes the mystery one step further back.
Because you can say, well, the universe exists because of the Big Bang.
Exactly. But then you are forced to ask why the laws of physics that allowed the Big Bang exist in the first place.
Like, where do the rules come from?
Yeah, or you point to quantum fluctuations in a vacuum, but then you have to explain where the vacuum and quantum mechanics came from. It's just this infinite regression of why.
And that infinite regression is exactly what we're wading into today.
It is.
Today's deep dive is tailored specifically for you, the intellectually curious listener who wants those profound aha moments without drowning in academic jargon.
Absolutely.
We are exploring a brilliant, highly structured metaphysical hypothesis that attempts to answer not just why the universe exists, but why you exist as a fragmented, limited individual.
And this is based on a fascinating 2026 bilingual philosophical essay by Marius Jans.
Right, it's called The Fragmented Mind, why a unified consciousness might need a world of separate selves.
Or, as he calls it, perspective theory.
So before we jump in, we should probably set some ground rules, right?
Yeah, we should definitely establish right out of the gate that Jans himself is very careful to clarify this is a metaphysical hypothesis.
We're not saying this is hard science.
Right. We are not declaring this as some empirically proven scientific fact that you can test in a particle accelerator.
Okay, got it.
But it is a rigorously argued, beautiful way of reimagining the fundamental nature of reality. And the essay weaves together this incredible tapestry of intellectual literature.
Oh, yeah, it pulls from everything, right? Like cognitive science, ancient Eastern philosophy, modern thought experiment.
Exactly. We'll be touching on Thomas Nagel's work on the inner lives of bats, David Chalmers' hard problem of consciousness, and even Alan Watts.
So, okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with the bedrock of how we currently understand reality.
Good place to start.
Because to grasp what perspective theory is doing, we have to look at the default worldview most of us just, walk around with.
The standard story baked into every biology textbook.
Right. The sequence usually goes something like this. In the beginning, there is just matter, dead, empty, unconscious stuff,
Yeah.
rocks, gas, carbon.
Right. And then over billions of years, that matter clumps together. Chemistry happens.
Biology and life eventually emerge from this primordial soup.
And from that biological life, you get evolutionary pressure, which builds complex nervous systems.
And those nervous systems eventually build brains.
Exactly.
And then finally, at the very end of this massive cosmic assembly line, consciousness emerges.
So mind is treated as a late-stage byproduct of matter. That's the standard materialist sequence.
Matter is fundamental, mind is the byproduct.
Yes. And, we have to acknowledge that this framework has been incredibly successful at explaining the mechanics of the universe.
I mean, neuroscience has made staggering leaps using this assumption.
Oh, completely. We can map neural signals with breathtaking precision. We can put you in an fMRI machine and tell you exactly which region of your hippocampus lights up when you recall a memory.
Right, we can track how a photon of light bounces off an apple, hits the retina, turns into an electrical signal.
Travels down the optic nerve and is processed in the visual cortex. It's a mechanical marvel.
Which is an incredible feat. But here is the structural flaw with that view, right? It completely fails to account for the subjective experience of the apple.
Yes, that is the massive gap.
Science can map the brain processing the wavelength of light we call red, but it cannot explain why the color red actually feels like red to you.
Right. Why is there an inner movie playing?
Yeah, exactly. Why is there an I am here experiencing the data rather than just a biological robot processing it in the dark?
And that conceptual gap is what philosopher David Chalmers termed the hard problem of consciousness back in the 90s.
Because the easy problems aren't actually easy, right?
No, he used easy very relatively. The easy problems are the mechanical ones. how the brain integrates information, how we focus attention.
But the hard problem is the sheer mystery of subjective experience itself.
Exactly. If the universe is just a machine made of dead, unconscious matter interacting according to blind physical laws, you could easily imagine a universe where stars burn and planets form.
And organisms react to their environments, flee predators, all without a single spark of inner experience.
Right. The lights are on, but nobody is home. The materialist worldview really struggles to explain why consciousness was invited to the party at all.
So, perspective theory asks us to look at this seemingly unsolvable problem and, like, execute a radical reversal.
Drawing on a philosophical tradition known as idealism, yes.
What if we have the entire sequence backward? What if consciousness isn't the final accidental byproduct of matter?
What if consciousness is the fundamental starting point of reality itself, and matter is the byproduct?
Which is a massive paradigm shift.
It really is. But to understand Jantz's formulation, we need to distinguish it from other theories, like panpsychism.
Right. Panpsychism is the one that says everything has a tiny bit of consciousness.
Right. No. Thinkers like Philip Goff talk about this. It suggests that the tiniest fundamental building blocks of matter, electrons, quarks, possess rudimentary microscopic bits of consciousness.
I've always struggled with that one, honestly.
Why is that?
Well, it treats consciousness like cosmic Lego bricks. You take a billion semi-conscious atoms, snap them together into a brain, and suddenly you get human awareness.
It is a bit counterintuitive.
Yeah, how do a billion separate, tiny minds fuse into one unified mind that can, I don't know, worry about paying taxes?
You've just described what philosophers call the combination problem. How do micro-subjects combine into a macro-subject?
It seems like a huge logical hurdle.
It is, and this is where perspective theory steps in, aligning much closer to a model called cosmopsychism.
Okay, cosmopsychism.
Yes, or it's very similar to Bernardo Kastrup's analytic idealism. In this view, you don't start with tiny fragmented blocks. You start with the whole.
So the universe itself is one fundamental unified ground of consciousness.
Exactly.
I love the analogy for this. It's like realizing that the television screen in your living room doesn't actually create the actors and the script out of its own wires and glass.
That's a great way to put it.
The broadcast signal exists first. It's everywhere. The physical television is just the localized device making that invisible signal visible in your house.
Right. The TV doesn't generate the broadcast. It tunes into it, filters it, and restricts it to a specific channel.
So in this framework, you, the listener, are not a separate consciousness that magically popped out of dead matter.
No, you are a localized, bounded center within that one universal broadcast. You are a specific perspective.
But wait, here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
If the underlying consciousness is this infinite, boundless whole, and we are just pieces of it, wouldn't we retain some of that grandeur?
You would think so, right?
Yeah. Like, why are we so incredibly limited, flawed, and confused all the time? If reality is just one giant perfect mind, why on earth would it willingly shatter itself into billions of tiny, isolated, stressed out pieces?
It's a great question. Why become a human stuck in rush hour traffic?
Exactly.
This brings us to what we might call the curse of absolute perfection.
The curse of perfection.
Yeah. If we postulate a primordial consciousness that is infinite, we are describing a state that lacks absolutely nothing.
So it's unbound by time, unbound by space.
Right. It knows every single fact, every possible future, every thought, every potential outcome simultaneously.
Which sounds divine on paper, but I'm trying to actually imagine existing in that state.
It gets boring very quickly.
It reminds me of being a kid and discovering cheat codes in a video game.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
You punch in the code and suddenly you have infinite health, infinite money, every weapon is unlocked. The whole map is revealed.
And for the first 5 minutes, it's amazing.
It's hilarious. You are a god. But by minute 15, this profound, creeping emptiness sets in.
Because there's no challenge anymore.
Exactly. You can't be surprised. You can't actually achieve anything. The game becomes completely meaningless, and you just end up turning off the console.
That captures the structural dilemma perfectly. The deeper metaphysical problem here is that in a state of total, omniscient perfection, nothing new can ever be gained or experienced.
Because you already know everything.
Right. There is no movement from I don't know to now I know. You cannot experience bravery because you are never in danger.
You can't feel the warmth of meeting someone new because there is no other to meet. You are already everything.
So if you possess everything, you are paralyzed. You can't actually experience anything.
Wow. So perspective theory proposes that limitation, ignorance, and vulnerability are not tragic bugs in the system.
No, they are the absolute required features for experience to happen at all.
So the universal mind essentially has to put blinders on.
It must fragment itself into limited, restricted perspectives to experience the thrill of discovery, the tension of uncertainty, or even the contrast of joy and sorrow.
It's like rewatching a thriller movie. If you know exactly who the killer is, the tension is dead.
The only way to actually feel the adrenaline, to gasp at the twist, is to temporarily strip yourself of the knowledge of the ending.
That makes total sense. To experience suspense, you must be deprived of the outcome.
And to experience loss, you must be finite. Jans invokes a very famous metaphor here, often associated with Alan Watts.
Oh, I love Alan Watts.
Watts argued that we fundamentally misunderstand the universe when we treat life like a journey with a final destination.
Because if life were just about getting to the end goal, we'd all just want to skip to the end.
Exactly. The quickest route would be the best route. But life, Watts argued, is not a journey. It is a musical composition.
And the point of music isn't to get to the final note as fast as possible.
If that were true, the best symphony orchestras would just play the final crashing chord and go home.
Right. The value, the whole meaning, is in the unfolding of the melody in time.
Yes. If you heard every note of a Beethoven symphony at the exact same millisecond, which is what omniscience would be like, it wouldn't be music. It would just be deafening noise.
You need the silence between the notes. You need the restriction of time.
So the limitation creates the song.
Does this mean my daily moments of confusion or feeling completely lost about my future are actually supposed to happen?
In this framework, yes. That isn't a failure. It is the universe successfully executing its design to experience suspense.
That's kind of wild to think about.
But it naturally raises the next critical question, right?
Yeah, how does it build those limitations?
Exactly. How does it construct the blinders that turn omniscience into a specific point of view? And this takes us out of the realm of human psychology and forces us to look at the rest of the natural world.
Good, because we have this really arrogant habit of equating consciousness strictly with our own human experience.
We think consciousness requires human language or the ability to think like Descartes, I think. Therefore, I am.
But according to this theory, that's just one highly specific shape consciousness can take, right?
Jans refers to this shaping mechanism as the organismic architecture of access.
Architecture access. I like that.
Every biological form in the universe provides a different set of physical and sensory blinders, and those blinders open up completely different horizons of experience.
Or like a dog, for example.
Yes. A dog's world is fundamentally structured by smell. Its primary reality is this vivid, three-dimensional tapestry of chemical gradients that you and I are completely blind to.
So when a dog walks into a park, it's seeing a historical timeline of every animal that passed through, just purely through scent.
Or consider a bee, which sees ultraviolet patterns on flowers that are entirely invisible to the human eye.
It's not just that the dog and the bee are seeing the same world we are, just with different tools.
No, they are existing in a completely different phenomenal reality.
To deeply ground this, the text brings up Comus Nagel's legendary paper, right? What is it like to be a bat?
Arguably one of the most famous papers in the philosophy of mind. A bat uses echolocation to navigate.
It maps physical space by bouncing sound waves off bugs and walls.
Try closing your eyes and imagining that.
I can't even wrap my head around it. Imagine trying to navigate your living room. You can't use light, but you click your tongue, and the sound bouncing off the couch creates a 3D spatial map in your mind.
You aren't hearing the room. You are seeing the geometry through sound.
It's basically impossible for my human brain to simulate what that actually feels like.
And that was Nagel's entire argument. You can imagine what it would be like for a human to hang upside down in the dark, but you cannot conceive of what it is like for a bat to be a bat.
Because the subjective experience is locked behind a totally different architecture of access.
Exactly. No matter how well we map the bat's brain, science can't yield the subjective feeling of being the bat.
Which completely dismantles this idea of an evolutionary ladder, where we are sitting at the top with the most consciousness.
We aren't at the top. We are just one specific localized coordinate in a massive space of possible experiences.
So gaining a new sense wouldn't just mean more human consciousness. It would rewrite the rules of what can be experienced.
That is the crucial takeaway. The physical biology acts as a specific lens, filtering the universal consciousness into a distinct world.
Okay, I am entirely on board with the dog and the bat, but I have to push back here for a second.
Go ahead.
Where do we draw the line? Like, what about a sunflower?
The boundary question.
Because a sunflower physically turns its head to track the sun. A Venus flytrap snaps shut when a bug touches it. Plants react to light and gravity. Are they experiencing the world?
It's a profound question, and Jans addresses it directly. Under current biology, there is no scientific proof of subjective plant consciousness.
So functional reaction doesn't mean subjective experience.
Right. A thermostat reacts to temperature and turns on the heat, but we don't assume the thermostat is feeling cold.
Right, it's just a switch.
However, Jans includes this to highlight how strongly our definition of experiencing is biased by our own human biology.
We look for brains because that's what we have.
Exactly. Where the boundary lies between a mechanical reflex and an inner glimmer of experience is an open frontier. The point isn't to declare a sunflower is consciously enjoying the sun, but to realize consciousness might be fracturing itself into vantage points we can't even begin to imagine.
But if that is true, it introduces a massive structural problem, doesn't it?
Which one?
If I am a fragment of consciousness, and the dog is a fragment, what stops us from just drifting off into our own private, disconnected dream worlds?
The problem of solipsism.
Yeah. If we are all just subjective perspectives, why do we all see the same sky? When I throw a frisbee, why does the dog see the exact same frisbee and catch it?
It's a trap many idealist philosophies fall into. Jans's answer is that for perspectives to mean anything at all, they must be able to interact.
And to interact, they need a shared stage.
Yes. They require a shared, rule-governed structure of experience. This is what the physical world actually is. Gravity, thermodynamics, causality. Jans calls this shared resistance.
Shared resistance. So the world pushes back against our wishes.
Exactly. If you deeply desire to fly and you step off a ledge, gravity will resist your desire. You will fall.
You can't just imagine yourself full if you're hungry.
Biological reality resists you. You must consume calories. This resistance makes the world stable across all perspectives.
I love comparing this to an open-world multiplayer video game.
That's a great analogy.
You have millions of players, the perspectives, logging into the same server. We all have totally private experiences of the game. I can build a house. You can fight a monster.
But you are all bound by the exact same game engine.
Right. If I jump off a cliff in the game, the gravity engine pulls my avatar down completely, regardless of my subjective feelings about it.
That fits the architecture perfectly. Jans actually engages with Nick Bostrom's 2003 simulation hypothesis here.
Oh, the idea that we're literally living in an alien computer simulation.
Yes, but Jans draws a hard line to separate his theory from Bostrom's. Perspective theory does not require alien programmers or supercomputers built of metal and silicon.
Because Bostrom's theory just pushes the problem back a level, right?
Mm.
The alien computer's still made of physical matter.
Exactly. It's still materialism, just with extra steps. Jans proposes a metaphysical simulation.
So the shared physical world isn't code. It's a self-presentation of the underlying consciousness.
It is the necessary structure that allows fragmented perspectives to have a stable arena. And this shared resistance protects the theory from pure relativism.
Like the whole, everyone has their own truth, so nothing is real thing.
Right. Subjective meaning is flexible, but the physical stage is not. A heavy stone might mean different things. A foundation for a builder, a religious artifact for an archaeologist, shade for a beetle.
But physically, it's the exact same mass of minerals.
The shared resistance enforces the rules of the stage.
So we've established the physical rules. But what about the psychological rules specifically applied to you, the human player?
The human burden.
Because our specific human architecture allows for incredible things, but it comes with a terrifying cost.
It does. Humans have a radically expanded horizon of experience compared to other biological forms, due to what Jans calls temporal self-projection.
Temporal self-projection, meaning like time travel in our own minds.
Precisely. If we look at animal minds, citing research from Kristen Andrews and Franklin McMillan, animals absolutely feel extreme primary pain, stress, and fear.
A dog can mourn. An elephant can experience trauma.
But their experience is profoundly anchored in the present moment. Humans, on the other hand, can project their consciousness decades into a hypothetical future.
You can literally be sitting on your couch, perfectly healthy and safe, and suddenly suffer suffocating agony from the realization that you'll die in 40 years.
Yes. You can construct an ideal self in your mind and then suffer a depressive episode because your present reality doesn't match it.
The text ties this to literature on rumination, right?
Susan Olin Hoxima's work, yes. The abstract dread of long-term future tragedy is a uniquely human vulnerability. It's a consequence of our specific architecture.
So wait, what does this all mean for suffering? Does this imply human suffering is somehow worse or more important than animal suffering?
Jans firmly corrects that assumption. No, primary suffering is not less intense for an animal.
Oh, that's a huge relief, because I could see people twisting this to justify animal cruelty.
It's a vital ethical guardrail. The raw reality of an animal's physical pain is absolute. We might abstract the cycle of nature and narrativize it as a tragedy, but that doesn't minimize the acute reality of an animal's pain.
The horizon of experience is different, but the moral weight is identical.
Exactly. But this exact same temporal architecture gives us something else. Freedom.
Moral freedom, right?
Yes. Because we can weigh alternatives and project future outcomes, we become moral agents on the shared stage.
So concepts like courage, guilt, forgiveness, those are only possible because of this painful human architecture.
A mechanical reflex cannot be brave. Only a being that anticipates pain and consciously chooses to step into it anyway can experience courage.
The same architecture that lets you dread the future lets you be a hero. It's a mandatory package deal.
It is, which naturally transitions us to the ultimate questions. If you are a fragment of a larger consciousness, burdened with time and moral freedom, what happens when you die?
Right, because in the materialist view, death is the absolute end. The brain shuts down, the lights go out.
But in perspective theory, death is radically redefined. It is not the annihilation of consciousness itself, because consciousness is all that exists.
So what dies then?
Death is simply the end of a specific perspective. The text uses a wave metaphor.
I love this one.
Imagine a wave rising from the ocean. It takes a unique shape, moves across the surface, and crashes onto the shore. The wave is gone forever. But the water it was made of does not disappear.
So my memories, my personality, my human ego, that is the wave. And that wave absolutely ends.
Correct. But the underlying awareness, the water, just returns to the ocean.
And this reinterprets how we relate to each other, right?
Yeah.
If we are all just different waves on the exact same ocean, then love takes on this profound meaning.
Love is reinterpreted as self-knowledge. It is the underlying unified consciousness momentarily recognizing itself in another fragmented perspective.
So true empathy or deep romantic love is basically the universe managing to give itself a hug across the divide of two physical bodies.
It's a profound way to view connection. And Jans explicitly references the Advaita Vedanta here from the ancient Upanishads.
The idea that the deepest self is the ultimate reality.
Yes, Atman is Brahman, but Jans makes a highly critical distinction that separates perspective theory from classical Eastern mysticism. In traditional Advaita, the multiplicity of the world, the fact that there appear to be many separate people, is often treated as maya or illusion.
Right, like a veil you have to pierce to escape the cycle and merge back into unity.
But if we just merge back into perfect oneness, we'd be right back to the curse of perfection.
We'd lose the suspense and the ability to give ourselves a hug.
Exactly. Perspective theory claims this multiplicity is deeply valuable and structurally real. The separation is not a mistake to be fixed. The separation is the whole point.
We shouldn't be trying to escape the fragmentation. We should lean into it.
Yes. And this leads to a beautiful conclusion on meaning. Meaning isn't some external cosmic goal you have to achieve.
Meaning is just drinking a cup of coffee, feeling sad, listening to a song.
You are infinitely small in the cosmos, but infinitely significant, because your exact combination of memories and senses will literally never happen again.
When your wave crashes, that specific lens is gone forever.
You are an absolutely unrepeatable lens through which reality is experiencing itself.
That is incredibly empowering. But as much as I love the poetry of that, we promised our listeners a rigorous deep dive. We have to poke holes in this theory.
The stress test, or as Jans calls it, the Belastungsprobe.
Right. And the first major hurdle is what we can call the brain problem.
We have verifiable evidence that the physical brain dictates the mind. If you take anesthesia, your consciousness vanishes.
Or if you suffer a brain injury, your whole personality can change. This strongly supports the materialist view.
Perspective theory counters by arguing that the brain acts as the limiting mechanism, the lens.
Like if you scratch a camera lens, the light outside is fine, but the picture is distorted.
Right. Alter the brain, alter the restriction. But Jans admits the theory cannot empirically prove this. It's an unprovable metaphysical hypothesis.
I can live with that. But the hurdle I'm hung up on is the decombination problem.
It's a severe philosophical headache.
It's easy to say one universal ocean splitting into many waves, but how? What forms the hard boundary where I can't read your thoughts right now?
How does one giant mind cleanly decombine into billions of private minds? Jans acknowledges this as a major theoretical limit.
And there's Occam's razor, too. If physics and evolution explain reality perfectly well, why add a mystical shared consciousness to the mix?
A strict skeptic would say it adds an unnecessary, heavy metaphysical layer.
But the most crucial stress test is the ethics of suffering, right?
Yes. Jans delivers a very stark warning. We must never use this framework to justify trauma.
Oh yeah, like telling someone going through a tragedy, well, the universe just needed to experience this.
It is morally reprehensible, and the text explicitly forbids it. We cannot say your suffering was necessary for the universe to learn.
Just because the system requires vulnerability doesn't mean we passively accept pain. Real suffering must be alleviated.
Exactly. It's a framework for personal meaning, not an excuse for cruelty.
Wow. Okay, so let's wrap this up for the listener. We have gone from the freezing night sky to the origins of existence, flipping the scientific script.
We explored the curse of perfection and why an omniscient universe needs blinders.
We looked at the limits of bats and dogs, the heavy burden of human mental time travel, and the profound realization that you are an unrepeatable lens.
And if you take one thing into your day, let it be epistemic humility.
You can never truly know the inner world of the person on the train or the animal on the street. Honor that mystery.
Yes.
To leave you with a final provocative thought. Let's do a quick thought experiment from the text.
The hypothetical button.
Imagine a button right in front of you. If you press it, you instantly possess a perspective that knows every single choice you will ever make for the rest of your life.
You will know exactly how every event will turn out.
Will you press it? Perspective theory suggests that if you do, you gain total cosmic certainty, but you permanently lose the ability to ever experience hope, suspense, or surprise again.
The movie is permanently spoiled.
Would you trade your messy human ignorance for cosmic certainty?
It really forces you to see the hidden value of your own limitations.
So next time you look up at the stars on a freezing night, you're not just asking why you're here. You realize you are here because the stars needed a way to feel the cold.
Beautifully said.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning your reality, and we'll catch you next time.